You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.
Greetings, friends. Welcome to another thrilling edition of the Toilet of Hell radio show. If this is your first show, what we do here is we offer you music-related diversions that make your commute suck less. Just a little bit less. This is a show all about metal. We interview artists, we talk about news, we discuss the history of this genre that you all know and love. We listen to new music, and we make a lot of jokes. The show is pretty much just an avenue for us to make jokes, really. But if this is your 100th episode, thanks for sticking with us. If you like what we do here and you want to hear more, you can subscribe to our Patreon, and you get bonus episodes of this show. New content you haven't heard before, so just bear it in mind. Let's go ahead and get this one started. I am Joe Thrashenkill. With me today, I've got my co-host, 365 Days of Horror, and Brennicide. How's it going, fellas?
Hell yeah, man, it's going good. I've had a pretty wild weekend, but just in like terms of errands and stuff, you know.
Oh, okay. No cops or
drugs or busts or anything like that. But I've just had a great Sunday. I got to just kick back, cancel all my plans, and just chill for a bit.
Oh, there's nothing better than canceling plans.
Yes. It's just such a good feeling. I'm just like, no, I changed my mind. I'm disappointing everyone today.
Hell yeah. How about you, Jordan? How's it going?
Going okay. Let me just say, fuck the New England Patriots.
I didn't watch a second of football today, and you know what? I feel much better about it. I feel better about myself as a person.
I really haven't watched much all season, to be honest. I'm disgusted by the Patriots.
I'm kind of disgusted by the league, to be honest with you. Like, I no longer get as much enjoyment out of football, and I haven't gambled once on games this year, so yeah, I'm not even getting that out of it, so.
Oh, proud of you. Proud of you. So are we disgusted with the Patriots because they won or lost? Probably won, right?
They won. Of course
they won. Of course they did.
There's no justice.
Because they're fucking paid to, man.
It's like when, I don't know, just the 1-2 punch of like Donald Trump winning the presidency and then the New England Patriots winning the Super Bowl within like a month last year. It just really, it killed any desire I had to live outside of this bubble of like metal and humor.
Right. It's almost like multimillionaires are friends with each other.
Yeah, fuck them.
Oh, fuck it.
Well, I figured we'd do something a little different on this show. Jordan messaged our Facebook group and was like, hey, I was thinking about... Actually, Jordan, you tell us. What were you thinking about?
Well, I've been in the, I guess, internet metal community in many different forms for a long time, since I was maybe 14 years old. And I've seen like a lot of jokes come and go, but one that's always stuck around has been Celtic Frost's album Cold Lake. It's always been there as kind of like, this band's going to mess up and sound like Cold Lake, or this album that came out sounds like their version of Cold Lake. And I've always just kind of been interested in why that album is kind of become the standard for bands changing their sound and failing at it, and kind of like what other well-known bands have kind of done the same thing and have their own version of Cold Lake.
Yeah. It's sort of like, yeah, it's sort of like the heel turn in pro wrestling. Like a band just disappoints and just turns their back on everybody.
Yeah, the Hollywood Hogan.
Yes, exactly.
And it just like, It tickled me. The idea tickled me in such a way because I thought about it for half a second. I was like, oh, that band has their Cold Lake. That band has their Cold Lake. And it just, there are so many bands that I guess that they were lucky enough to have an actual legacy in the genre that they fucked around and put out an album that stepped outside the lines a little bit much and then just is the subject of ridicule for years. I mean, off the top of our heads, we did an entire show about Morbid Angel, but Illud Divinum Insanus is, of course, I guess this century's gold standard of the Cold Lake phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, a lot more people will probably bring up like Metallica's Black Album or Load rather than Cold Lake, just because if you talk about Metallica, every Walmart regular person knows who Metallica is, but maybe not so much Celtic Frost.
I bought Load and Reload at a Walmart.
Same.
But I didn't see Cold Lake there once.
No, right. Yeah, because I think it's equally infamous in the metal community that Metallica made that same sort of turn and just kind of went with what seemed to be cool at the time as opposed to what they were known for.
I don't know, man, because I remember buying Load and Reload and liking them at the time, and I don't recall that style of, I don't know, I guess bluesy rock and roll, hard rock being that popular at the time. I don't mean to be like a defender of those albums, because I mean I think we can all agree that they just don't quite hold a candle to the original genre defining thrash records that Metallica put out in the 80s, but
yeah,
I think that they're unfairly maligned.
I think it's a combination of things. I think it was a very poor attempt to cash in on the sort of grunge wave at the time, but in this combination, you got a guitarist like Kirk Hammett, who certainly has a lot of Southern rock influence in his solo playing. And I would say the same for James Hetfield, especially with the singing on those albums. Oh, my God. So you have those things kind of mishmashed together in this thing that actually sounds wholly different. Like, no band really made music like that before, which is strange that everyone hates it so much. It's unfortunate that it can't be kind of regarded for how original it really was.
Well, you know what they say. It ain't my bitch.
Hero See, now, for a day.
When it comes to those Metallica albums, personally, I don't think of those as their Cold Lake, because those albums were pretty successful, weren't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They sold a lot of records. Okay. I remember watching the band play Fuel on Saturday Night Live when I was a little boy. Which, I mean, that's a pretty big deal for a metal band, you know?
A little bit, yeah.
But
I'm not saying that's the only factor for like a band having their Cold Lake, but I would say that they kind of made this transition and they succeeded at it, whereas some of these other bands have tried to make a transition and didn't succeed at it. Well, I would venture to say like Saint Anger or even Lulu would be Metallica's Cold Lake.
Lulu is definitely Metallica's Cold Lake, because I mean, pairing up
it's just so different.
Lou Reed, a guy who sold a billion records since the 60s, and I was that Lou Reed's last record too? That poor bastard. It's just unlistenable, really.
The worship of someone who actively despises you. Who actively despises you. I am the view. I am the table.
So when we say Cold Lake, we're talking about something that more or less was universally panned, like not necessarily something that changed their that changed their sound in a way to be more commercial. It's like an album that maybe they tried to do that, but it's like an album that everybody just agrees to hate.
I think it's a little bit of everything. Like, I think another good example would be Megadeth's Risk.
Oh, boy, was it ever.
It's just such a big change, and it failed.
Wasn't it in a movie? Which movie was it in?
Universal Soldier.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
With Bill Goldberg.
Hell yeah, brother. The video for Crush 'Em is fantastic, featuring Bill Goldberg all throughout.
Dude, I can't say the same thing for the song.
Well, the song was actually, the band played it on WCW's Monday Night Nitro live.
Of course they did.
It's on YouTube, and the song is just so bad. I think with, like, Dave Mustaine's voice is very distinctive, and I think it works in certain cases, like talking about the government's trying to get you or I'm crazy. It doesn't work when he's trying to be tough, saying, crush him all.
Into the arena. Oh, my
fucking God, I hate this song.
All right, on a future episode, I want us to strictly discuss WCW musical guests.
That's okay. That's okay. I didn't even watch WCW back in the day. I was all Attitude Era, baby.
I watched both, man. I couldn't get enough. I had to have the wrestling in my veins.
Flipping between commercials, hoping they didn't play at the same time.
Well, I didn't have cable, so I had my buddy tape them. Oh.
Sick.
So I had all the time in the world to watch. But I guess Cold Lake, it is notable because, I mean, it was trying to cash in on the hair metal sound that was popular at the time. And it failed miserably, of course. Nobody wanted to hear this weird underground black metal band suddenly play Motley Crue covers. So there is in the Cold Lake effect something about reaching for another audience and just falling woefully short of it. I spent a lot of time listening to Slayer's 1998 record that I feel like is often looked at as the band's Cold Lake moment. As long as I've been a fan of metal, I've heard people speak derisively of this record. That would be Debabolus.
That's right. Yeah, you got it. Yep, that's right. Nailed it.
Diabolo in Musica. Nailed it. Have you guys ever heard that record?
I have.
Yeah.
Back to back. Ever.
Yeah.
We've all heard it.
I remember when I was a kid, I would see ads for this record, like in magazines. And I thought to myself, and I still think to myself, this cover art is fucking badass. Like,
yeah.
You can say a lot of things about this record, and we will here shortly, because we're going to talk about it a lot. But I think we all need to agree that this very industrial-looking image of some kind of pale-faced monk and the Slayer... the Slayer logo nowhere to be found, instead in this very Hexen or Doom id Software looking font.
Yeah, very Slayer good. Place. Yeah, very good description. This album was actually famously featured, I think. I could be remembering this wrong. It could be a Mandela effect. But this album was famously featured in a television commercial where a grandma got it for some like hip young lady for Christmas or her birthday or something. And she didn't want it because she was hip and young and cool. So she used some sort of resale service online. And then it ultimately ended up in the hands of two German Gothic teenagers who said in German or whatever language they were speaking and how cool Slayer was and how pumped they were to get the record.
I've never heard of this, so I'd like to believe that you just have a really vivid imagination.
Could have been a messed up sleep apnea dream. I don't know, but I'm pretty sure... I'm pretty sure this happened. We'll have to verify later.
Well, we'll do the research later.
But yeah, you're right about the album cover. It's very kind of Marilyn Manson, Nine Inch Nails-ish. It's not very Slayer at all.
It's very late 1990s.
Yeah. Which I think is, when done right, is a very cool aesthetic.
Excuse me.
And one that's ripe for a comeback, IMHO.
Well, there's a lot of interesting things about this record. Most interesting is the fact that they very much downtuned their guitars, kind of created a very, it was its own sort of thing. It was like an experimental record, much in the same vein as like Black Album or Load, where it didn't really sound like anything else except Slayer doing something totally different. But it was like they were trying to incorporate what was cool at the time and then how Slayer knew how to write music and then created something that was pretty strange, but I don't know. Looking back on it, it had some jams. I mean, Bitter Peace is a cool song. I don't care what anyone says. Maybe I'm wrong.
This record's been pretty well disowned by the band over the years.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I understand these guys are they have a reputation to withhold, and they don't want to do anything that would affect the bottom line at Slayer LLC.
Right.
Because in the years since 1998, when this record came out, Slayer, I could be wrong. Maybe I wasn't aware of it at the time, but they have become a merch machine. Where it's very much a business endeavor. Everyone, they're playing every festival they possibly can every year. And when they put out a new record, it's got to sound, I mean, pretty much the same as six other records that they put out.
Honestly, they haven't put out an album that didn't sound like this since, to be frank. I don't know why they disown it when they just keep making it over and over. And to go along with the wrestling analogies we love so much, Slayer is like the John Cena of the metal community right now. They keep pumping out merch. They keep showing up when nobody fucking wants them anymore. And they're squashing new talent everywhere they go.
It's what sells, you know?
Right.
When they play live, they just play the same hits, I guess you could say.
I mean, have you guys ever seen Slayer live?
Yes.
I have as well. Have you?
Yeah.
All of us?
Yes.
Okay. sorry, I'm trying to get to a point here, buddy. I saw them headline a festival in which they were given 2 hours to perform. No one has ever needed to listen to 2 hours of Slayer straight. It's too much. And, like, I just want to hear the hits, man. Like, there is not enough variation in your discography to really do this, which is why I think Diabolus in music is so interesting, because there is some variation here. Like you mentioned, Breno, what's most notable about this record is that the band tuned down to, I believe it was C or C sharp.
C sharp, yeah.
Yeah, and it's heavy, of course, yeah. Because, I mean, when you tune down, it makes it sound heavier. Therefore, the lower the tuning, the heavier your band is.
Yeah, it's very common in that sort of time frame. You had a lot of bands like Korn and Limp Bizkit and such sort of coming up the way.
You had kids playing with the Ibanez 7-string Universe guitars, and I guess these guys were just like, well, I guess we can try to keep up with these stupid kids are into. And that's kind of what it is. This record is notable for being tuned down lower. For Tom Araya, like, buying one of those Korg Chaos pads for his voice and occasionally, like, manipulating the sound effects there, which I think is a very cool effect. And there's a lot of bounce riffs, which I think in the context they seem a little bit outdated, but the bounce riff is also due for a comeback, IMA show. So the album starts with Bitter Peace, which is roughly 2 minutes of just a straight nu metal riff before going into what I would say is a standard Slayer song, just with a lower tuning. That's an interesting change for the record.
Right. And then I think I look back on it more fondly than I probably would have embraced it as a Slayer fan in the time, you know, because music back then, you don't hate it as much as you used to, because there's so much worse that has come out since.
That's fair.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, after that, it goes into Death's Head, which, in my mind, actually sounds like a super heavy System of a Down song. Scrum? Did you guys remember the song Scrum?
I think so, yeah.
It's been a long time. Only metal song I'm aware of, at least, that's about rugby. Like, yeah, the lyrics are like, full contact, while I live and breathe, sidestepping all the human debris.
I mean, I'm pretty sure it's like an analogy for moshing, right?
No, because it's straight up like baseline, goal line, overtime, killing time. It's straight about rugby. I guess Hanneman was into rugby briefly. I don't know.
Yeah, you always wore jerseys and stuff. That's probably true.
Yeah, but it was always football jerseys. Like,
was it? Was it hockey jersey?
I thought it was Raiders. It was a Raiders jersey. Raiders and San Raiders, Jose you're Sharks.
Right.
Yeah.
You're right. Yep. You're right. Yeah, he had a Raiders logo on his ESP guitar, too.
Yeah.
Big Raiders fan.
And a Heineken logo on the guitar. Died from never mind.
So that's okay. Move on.
Sorry about that. When we talk about the stain of nu metal from the 90s, people like to say that it affected everyone. I mean, you had Sepultura suddenly becoming a bounce riff machine. You had Slayer putting out what the DMU crowd would derisively declare as a new metal record. But I thought it was interesting. I went back and looked at some of the reviews from the era when this came out to see what they had to say about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I came across this New York Times review from a guy named Ben Ratliff, who is a generalist pop music reviewer. He has several books about jazz, if that means anything to you.
Ew. Oh boy.
Yeah. If you Google his name, he looks exactly what you would think he would as a New York Times music snob.
Just pick up my my paint swatches of different white colors.
Yeah, exactly.
See which one.
Exactly. And
here's New York Times.
So I came across this review and I feel like I have to share this with you. If that's okay.
Go right ahead. All ears.
Okay, this from June 22nd, 1998. This is titled Pop Review. It's a major metal band, and even the furniture isn't safe. Okay. Ben Ratliff writes, it's hard not to resort to metaphor in describing a Slayer concert, because what you're confronted with is both kinetically massive and uniform, blank, detailless. In 1986, the band recorded Rain and Blood, an album that's still the primary sacrament of death metal. The short, powerful record mixes the rhythms of hardcore punk with a single-minded focus on ritual violence. As a lot of defunct death metal bands have since found out, carnage and devilry are a tricky songwriting trope. Unless you make a living as a torturer, you can only imagine in so many ways before you get tangled up in cliches and clunky Victorianisms that goes so well with decadent themes. I just want to pause for a second here and say, Slayer, that death metal band we all know and love, the big four of death metal tour that they, were so famously on.
Right. The pioneers of death metal, godfather of death metal, Kerry King.
Yeah, exactly. Ben obviously did his research on this one.
Right. Probably heard the word death metal, knew that there was a song about some death in there somewhere, and just sort of put the two and two together.
It's just one of those metalhead pet peeves where everybody describes everything as death metal, and it is in the Gray Lady, that fine institution, the New York Times. Anyway, I digress. Continuing. But metal, for some reason, continues to need words. And where they were prolific in the 80s, now the band's songwriters squeeze out a batch of malevolent scenarios every 3 years or so. Imagine humanity's decline, sings Tom Araya in one of the band's songs on its new album, Diabolus. God damn it. Diabolus in Musica. Step inside my stain of mind, infesting superiority, infectious immortality. Oh yeah. Let the metaphors begin. Oh yeah. Watching Slayer's show at Irving Plaza on Wednesday night was no more or less interesting than watching an enormous furnace for 90 minutes. It was like being crushed by an archetype. the members of Slayer constructed the language of death metal, and in concert, they set about deploying it purely, with as little variation as possible. This enforces the in-crowd aspect of the music. If you have to ask at this point, you'll never know. And as an aside here, if he would have asked, somebody would have said, dude, this is thrash metal. It's not death metal.
Right.
But if just you have to ask, you'll never know, but I won't ask because right. I don't want to. I'm sorry. I digress. Continuing. The drummer Paul Bostaff began the show with a few triplet rhythms that gave way to a single slab-like beats spaced apart. It was a teasing ritual. Then the speed metal of Hell Awaits began. Typically, the songs flickered between two-beat rhythms and a starchily funky four, with a flowing histrionic high-note guitar solo nailed somewhere in the middle. Slayer's pleasures are purely physical. Some of the show's best moments were the pockets of winded silence after the band ended a 400 beats per minute song and before the fans could physically raise a cheer. That kind of reminds me of like the Statler and Waldorf thing from the Muppets show. Like, what was your favorite part? It's the ending.
Paul Bostaff, interestingly enough, he's quoted as saying this is his favorite album.
Interesting. I have two more paragraphs here, and I think that this is the most interesting part because out of everything that we've read here, none of it has been about the album itself, which is, this is supposed to be an album review.
Right.
This next paragraph I'm about to read you is his album review. Are you ready?
As opposed to Safari diary of some kind.
Yes, with no starchily funky fours in this. Okay. We're gonna get into it. 8 of the 11 songs on Diabolus and Musica, a few of which were played at the show, are in the same gray key, and the band's rhythmic ideas have a wearying sameness too. Other major metal bands, Pantera, Metallica, Megadeth, at this point more than a decade into their careers, are diverse by comparison. In a career retrospective show like the one at Irving Plaza, you can feel it's all one barreling song. And I think that's an interesting review because he said that 8 of the 11 songs are in the same key. I can't verify that off, you know, the top of my head at the moment, but I feel like these are chromatic riffs, and as such, they're all kind of keyless.
Probably. I can only assume this is one of those music snobs who would just be able to tell right away, so... I'll take his word for it. He's probably right. Thinking back with what little music theory knowledge I have about Slayer and this album, he's probably totally right. I mean, think of how many like down to an open riffing there is, you know.
Fair. I mean, it's just...
Just a fucking smug, stupid thing to say.
Well, when we're talking about metal, oftentimes we're not talking about music in standard terms. Using a key, for example, when you're... Right. Basically just playing chromatic riffs all over the fretboard isn't necessarily the most helpful way to describe it.
Yeah.
Jordan, you're a musician. What do you think about that?
I'm not a musician. I'm a vocalist.
I don't gotta carry shit.
I've been known to play a bass line or two in my day.
So, what does this review from some weird jazz reviewer in the late 90s in the New York Times tell us about this record?
Why the fuck was this review even written?
I have no idea. I guess they had to have...
Right. Like, no, I'm sure you don't know, but it's like...
Like you said, it was the Safari beat. Like, oh, Ben, put on your patched leather sleeves and go out and see what the ruffians are up to.
Right. This was like going to the zoo for this guy. He clearly went to some Slayer show, stood in some fucking... VIP-ish section above the crowd where he could watch the mayhem unfold and write these fucking stupid metaphor driven, if not simile driven, boring ass crap about how it's like watching a thin, it's the 90 middle. It's just like, dude, fuck off. Like, he's right. He's absolutely right. If you have to ask, then don't. It's just like, fucking leave.
Yeah, and I hate to have that, like, elitist attitude about this, but this is a guy that didn't get it, didn't want to get it.
Right.
I think that's the biggest thing. You have to at least have some desire to want to know more about this, which he didn't.
Well, that's so interesting you say that, because this guy is like an elitist above all of us. He's like, I'm a music writer. I listen to jazz. He's like way above us as far as he thinks. So he comes in to, you know, get a good chuckle and write it down in his freaking parrot cage lining rag. So, yeah, that's my take. Anyhow, moving on.
But I mean, this is what people were writing about the record when it came out. And none of it is terribly useful. The reviews that I've seen in going through these archives are all just, you know, kind of like, it sounds like Slayer. It's very much the same, but it's really not. It's one of the few departures this band has ever had. And it's worth noting that somebody should have said, like, hey, this song kind of sounds like System of a Down, and that's cool.
Yeah. The late 90s really... Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Well, I was just going to say, the thing is, they're not going to say it sounds like System of a Down because System of a Down had, like, just started to come out at that time. So
that's fair.
That's a little bit of looking backwards. I would say, in defense of people saying it sounds like Slayer, what I think is with a lot of these albums is it's still, like, the main guys doing it. So it's going to sound like Slayer because it's Tom Araya.
No, he's
the voice of Slayer. So he's going to sound like Slayer regardless of how the rest of it really sounds.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because I think Tom Araya's vocals changed in this album, like the way he delivered them just in this very certain way. And then after he started doing that kind of, I don't know, hip-hop-ish bark of yelling. I don't even know how to describe it. It's like he's been doing that exact same shit ever since, and not ever since has he kind of done the more guttural, high-pitched, crazy shit he used to do back in the 80s. Probably because he can't, but...
Yeah, on that album, like, Stain of Mine comes to, you know... He almost sounds like he's rapping. Well, like it's real close to it.
I'd say that's the most nu metal song on the record. That's just a bounce riff fest. I would be remiss if I didn't search the death metal underground for a review of Diabolus and Musica, and I found one from 1998.
No shit, really?
Yeah. I don't know who wrote it, because it doesn't include a byline on it, because I guess this is, I don't know, they were probably still updating this, like, on CompuServe or something at the time.
Right. Yeah, sure. What is it? Is there any like, keynotes in there that are worth...
I mean, I don't know who wrote it, but I do know that whoever didn't have a great command of writing, which is shocking if you're familiar with the output of the DMU.
Great.
So they've been consistent for 20 years, is what you're saying.
But the review is two paragraphs if you want me to read it.
Please.
Yeah, okay. we'll do it.
Cool. Should I do it in death metal underground voice or normal voice?
In normal, one paragraph in death metal.
Yeah, first normal, second DMU voice.
Okay, you got it. Approximating some ideas from new bands who rose while Slayer was enduring 15 years in the music business, this new album features riffs that sound more like later death metal during verses and chanted choruses over bouncy riffs that are more like what Metallica was shipping 5 years previous. A few chords create motion, and then the riff rides around a single chord in a single rhythm to allow drums and vocals to take center stage, accommodating a new vocal style that incorporates more melody and a compositional style that is more like rock in its use of rhythmic expectation. The combination of foreboding riffs and jaunty emotional choruses transitions Slayer towards the cutting edge of nu metal, where it meets the underground and shifts into the public eye. An album that might not delight fans of older material, but approximates what a younger audience recognize as the norm.
Oh boy. Did they give it any sort of number review?
I'm afraid not.
I mean, I don't like numbers, but I just feel like it would be I guess they didn't like it. They didn't really say anything. It didn't seem to be a review so much as just a description of what they heard.
There were chords and then there were drums. But I think this also goes to show that Death Metal Underground is for posers, because this was before they figured out that they could just call everyone a Jew or a cuck and then say that the record is for hipsters.
Yeah.
So there you go. Death Metal Underground, big fan of Diabolus in Musica. Throughout the show, we're going to intersperse little clips of all these songs.
If you do put in a clip of a song, you got to put like the title track for Forbidden by Black Sabbath. I've never heard this album. Okay. So I'm right with you guys in the fact that I have no previous experience with it. I only specifically listened to it for this podcast, and it is terrible.
Okay, first and foremost, so you look at the Forbidden by Black Sabbath. Like, right. What year did that come out?
1995.
Okay. It's a bad year for metal.
Bad year for all of us. It was the Black Sabbath Tear era lineup from 1990.
Who was on vocals for that?
Tony Martin was on vocals.
Oh, okay.
And just about nobody from the original lineup. It was pretty much Geezer Butler by himself and a bunch of other hired guns.
Where was Tony Iommi?
Wait, what did I say, Geezer Butler? I'm sorry. I meant Tony Iommi. Tony's always been in the band.
Okay.
Right. Tony has always been in the band, but this was Tony and a bunch of just random guys. And the music is like nothing you would have ever expected from Black Sabbath. It's pretty bad. It's kind of like White Snake-y, if I had to guess. Very, very arena rock. It's just it's absolute shit. And it's pretty much critically panned. It's definitely like the cold lake of the band. If you go and you look up like Black Sabbath albums ranked from worst to best, this one is usually the worst, very typically. And the album cover is hilarious. It's like, if you look at it, it looks like some kind of like Chinese knockoff of a Black Sabbath shirt or something. Like, it's just like a random picture of the like a Grim Reaper or something, and it's got this Black Sabbath. It's just written on the top, but you never know it's a Black Sabbath album by looking at it.
Yeah, this looks like a Deschere Zone meme.
Yeah, not quality stuff.
So the title track is the one that you really swear by on this.
I would recommend. Oh. I mean, probably because it's the only one I listen to. That's all I need. So there's that.
Well, people have varying opinions about Black Sabbath. Personally, I mean, like, people really, really shit on albums like Technical Ecstasy as well. Like, a lot of people think that's one of the nadir of the Black Sabbath catalog. I guess possibly because they're not aware that this album came out.
Yeah. I think it's so interesting how much they change style depending on the vocalist. Like, I don't know if Iommi just he had a different influence musically when he had different guys singing, but like the Dio stuff doesn't sound anything like the Ozzy stuff, and you know, so on and so forth.
Yeah, but there was the guy from Deep Purple that also sang for them, whatever his name was. I'm gonna call him Paul.
Yeah.
But you know, fair. I don't know if we've ever talked about this on the show. I really don't fuck with Black Sabbath past the Aussie stuff. I do not enjoy the Dio years or the, I don't know, Tony Martin or Ian Gillan. Ian Gillan, yeah, that's the guy.
You don't like the Dio stuff from Black Sabbath?
I don't, man. I remember when I was like in the sixth or seventh grade, like me and my shitty friends, like we were listening to a lot of Aussie solo stuff and a lot of Black Sabbath stuff. And one of them bought one of the non-Aussie records. It was a Dio record. And I was like, what the fuck is this? This shit sucks. And I've always felt that way ever since then. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Come on. It's good metal. It's just objectively good metal. Like, Mob Rules is a great fucking record. Heaven and Hell, too. Heaven and Hell is a little sludgier than Mob Rules. Mob Rules is just, I don't know, it's got the riffs, man. Can't knock it. You got to listen to it again. Yeah, I mean, I can understand if you went into it being an Ozzy-era fan and then being like, what the hell is this? I get that totally. But with the knowledge and adulthood you have now, you should go back and try again. That's a fucking homework assignment, young man.
Maybe. I just Googled Black Sabbath singers. There were a lot of Black Sabbath singers. Yes. I don't know if you guys were aware of this.
I'm finding this out.
There's an Uzi Osbourne, a Ronnie James Dio, Ian Gillan, Tony Martin, who's on this record, correct? Forbidden?
Yeah, Tony Martin, yeah.
Something called a Glenn Hughes that looks like an SNL parody of a 70s singer. Something called a Ray Gillan, a Dave Walker who looks like a corpse in this picture, and David Donato, who probably fucked our mothers in the 80s.
Yeah. What else we got in the 90s? Speaking of Dio, he put out Angry Machines in the 90s, which was – it was the Dio solo career, and that's widely regarded as one of his worst albums. He's made some – people kind of liked the 2000-ish stuff a little more. I don't know if it was just – it seemed kind of like a self-serving ego boost to put that shit out. It was just nothing really spectacular, but this was just really different and strange, Angry Machines. I listened to a little bit of it before the show.
What's it sound like?
Not good.
Can you get a little more specific, please?
It's weird. It's like groovier and sludgier, and it's just a like the style of metal that just doesn't really match Dio's style of vocals. I mean, whenever I hear Dio records, I am just – it's like power and might, you know? It's just how it should always be. Swords held up high. That's the kind of shit that Dio records should convey. And this one was just – it was weird. I didn't listen to a lot of it, but I was kind of going through and trying to do a little bit of research on some widely regarded bad metal albums from bands that were liked. And I know I'm going to get shit for bringing this one up because you guys will just cleverly retort that none of their albums were good. But Anthrax Volume 8, The Threat Is Real, is so bad they don't even have it on Spotify. You can't even listen to it. It's now, a very, very bad
what
album.
What makes this a bad Anthrax album as opposed to the rest of the Anthrax albums?
Wow, it's like I asked for it openly. The thing is, the Bush stuff, it's not all terrible. Song for song, some of it's pretty bad, but you can pick and choose some stuff. But Volume 8 is just trash. It's just terrible. Like, there's no redeeming qualities at all. It's this really just ham-fisted, aggressive approach to music with really bad quality recording. And it just wasn't like anything they put out or anything any Anthrax fan should expect to hear. It was just really strange. And everybody hated it.
What year did that one come out?
I think that was later in the 90s, maybe 98 if I had to guess.
Sounds like 98 was like the cursed year because that's Diabolus in Musica and that's Virtual 9 from Iron Maiden as well.
Oh, I was called Virtual 11. I'm
fucking
I'm a numeral again.
I'm which one is it? I have to know for sure now. Yes.
Which one?
I had never listened to the quote unquote bad Maiden album until Jordan sent me the music video for what was that song called?
Something about a gambler.
Yeah, it was set in space and there were like claymation aliens.
The Angel and the Gambler.
Okay.
Wow.
And that song was fun because it was just like, I don't know, like blues hammer, like very, very bar like band. Definitely not Maiden-ish.
What was it? Was it Blaze Bailey?
Yeah,
yeah, it was Blaze Bailey.
He does not sing well. He's not a good singer. I first, I guess, became aware of Iron Maiden as like an actual entity when Brave New World came out. Because I remember like The Wicker Man, that song was getting a lot of play on the radio, and then I started like diving into the band like from there. And I guess I had somehow just completely missed out on this record entirely. It's a shame because it's something.
The first Iron Maiden song I ever heard in my entire life was actually Falling Down with Blaze Bailey, unfortunately. And I got it on this ridiculous bootleg, like, Best of Metal album that was just random metal bands. And it was just called, like, Best of Death Metal something something. And I don't know where the hell it came from or who put it together, but Iron Maiden was on it, so clearly whoever put it together didn't know what they were talking about.
Maybe you wrote for the New York Times.
That must have been it.
Probably.
Ah, there it is. New York Times Best of Death Metal. Iron Maiden and Slayer.
What was really coming to your mind when we were thinking about this entire concept, Jordan?
I think we hit on a lot of them. Definitely Metallica, Megadeth. In Flames is another one.
Oh, yeah.
A little bit later. A lot of people would point to Reroute to Remain. I would say it would probably be the album afterwards, Soundtrack to Your Escape, that was kind of a full change in how they sounded and left a lot of fans in the dust.
I think Reroute to Remain played with the concept a little more, and then you're right, the next album was just full tilt, heel turn. Just fuck everything, fuck our fans. We're in this for what we're doing right now.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoy Reroute to Remain. I think there's some good songs on it, and they still sound like In Flames, whereas Soundtrack to Your Escape is, okay, this is a new sound, and this is what they're going forward with, and it's just not good.
So one question I wanted to bring up to you guys is, I know obviously we talk about Morbid Angel, but they're still kind of like a band that has some history to them. They've been widely regarded for a while. They've been around for decades. Do we have any more modern examples, either of you? Of an album that was released by a band that maybe not be so old, but a lot of people didn't like. And
I mean, it's really tough to come for a band to have that kind of legacy and then just kind of fuck it all up. And part of that is that there aren't that many newer bands that have been able to create a legacy like that for themselves, you know? Because Morbid Angel started in the like early 80s. And they didn't really fuck it all up until I believe it was 2008.
I kind of have an example.
Yeah.
So a lot of guys bring up Mastodon as a band that turned very harshly at a certain point in their career from a certain style. Like before you had albums like Remission and Leviathan being a bit more melodic than Remission. Certainly Remission was a lot more like, you know, harsh underground sludge. And then you had Leviathan, which still kind of stuck that way in some points. But I don't know if I'd know if it was such a harsh turn. I think they very eventually went that way. And there's certainly albums they put out now that I really like. Like, I liked the last one. And I liked, I thought Once More Around the Sun
was the last
okay.
one, cracking open a cold, dark place with the boys.
That's what it was. Yeah. That one was pretty cool. cracking open a cold, dark place with your boys. But The Hunter, everybody who I talk to in the metal community fucking hates that album. Hmm. It's not that different from some of their stuff, but nobody liked it.
Yeah, that's the album that made me not like Mastodon anymore.
Right. People hated Crow of the Burl. They thought it was a stupid radio grab.
It was a really shitty song.
Yeah, it's just a stupid song. It was a dumb song. I think that was that other song. Change your hair, change your clothes. It's just like, what the fuck are you guys doing? I think that's probably a really great example of if Mastodon had a Cold Lake, it'd probably be that album. A lot of people argue Crack the Sky is where they turned, but Crack the Sky was like really adult and really progressive and had really long songs and was very intricately composed. Whereas The Hunter, I feel like, had a lot more of this sort of pop rock shit that they do now that a lot of people don't like.
That's fair. By the way, like I Googled earlier, like 1998 metal albums. Just to see like if anybody else completely destroyed their legacy in that year. And yes, as a matter of fact, someone did. not strictly metal, although definitely like, you know, responsible for a lot of metal. Van Halen released Van Halen 3
yes.
that year.
The, 3, yep.
The Forgotten Record with Gary Cherone. I could have sworn that I've heard this album at some point in my life, but I don't remember anything about it, and I feel like I gotta go back and listen to it now. Because that's one of those records that's just a punchline.
It's kind of like New Bon Jovi, if I remember correctly.
I mean, there are worse things that you could be if you were like an adult contemporary rock band like Van Halen.
Yeah. But it's just like, you know, hit a power chord and then just, you know.
Wait, no.
Wail about.
Shit, one of those songs was on like the Twister soundtrack, I think. Oh, I can't remember.
Twister the movie? Like
yeah.
The tornado movie?
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Shit. we gotta figure this out. I know that Sammy Hagar song with Van Halen was in the Power Rangers movie.
No, yeah, you're right. It was 1996. Humans Being was featured in the movie Twister, but that featured Sammy Hagar. It was the last recording to feature his vocals. I'm sorry.
Sammy Hagar had all the real good hits.
That's not
well. This song was used for the Crystal Pepsi commercial.
Right now,
hey,
this is the future.
The yeah. future is clear soda.
Yeah, at the end of the Power Rangers movie, after they defeated Ivan Ooze and they were all hugging together, and there was fireworks. It was like hiya and hiya. It was great. It was the most '90s moment of my life.
That kicks ass.
You were asking about other modern bands that have had their Cold Lake album. One that yeah. came to mind was Opeth's Heritage.
Yes. Mm. Very good. Very good example.
You got two definite camps on that, though. Like, not everyone is going to stand in a circle and be like, no, because you have a lot
True.
Of prog dads that are like, yes, this is good.
It's like, as I became a prog dad, so did Opeth.
As I became a prog man, I put away childish things.
Damn it.
Yeah, you do make a good point. There definitely are people that still love what they do now, but I think that is the album where there is such a shift and going away from what made them popular to begin with. And I would say, you know, their albums and ticket sales aren't as good as they used to be because of it.
I think Gojira's latest is a bit controversial.
Yeah, I it sounds like butt rock to me, but that's one of my hot takes that has yet to like really take off. The next record that's going to be playing at a Gold's Gym near you. It's
a Gojira gym.
It's going to have bass drops. It's going to have wiki turntable scratches.
Tight. It should have Macklemore featured on a guest.
It might. Yeah. You never know.
A song with nothing but pick scrapes.
So that's where we're at. There are so many other records that like just completely destroyed the legacy of a band. Discharge, you know, like the D-beat punk band that Smelly Kids, like they sew their patch on their jacket. They put out in a record in the 80s called Grave New World, which is actually a lot of fun to listen to, even though it sucks ass. It's definitely them trying for like cock rock hair metal. It's fun. They destroyed every bit of goodwill that they had back in the 80s when they released this. They would play shows on tour and like the punks would just throw shit at them.
A bit of a controversial release from a band that's near and dear to my heart. I can't remember the year it was released, but Anal Cunt released probably the most experimental album of their career called Picnic of Love.
In a way, it's forward thinking in a way that that you would never expect from that band.
Right. Didn't quite get them on the radio, but gosh, they tried. They came close.
I hesitate to say this because it has so much baggage with it. I like Anal Cunt's music for the most part, but that record is unlistenable. Because the entire way it's Seth just like, I respect your feelings as a woman and as a friend.
I respect your feelings. I respect your gender. I respect your existence. I'll always be tender because I respect your feelings as a woman and a
Sounds like any pop song to me. I don't know.
Yeah, they all sound like that. Every one of them. If anything, that really cemented the band's legacy rather than detracted.
I don't know the real story, but I think the hype train towards that album is like he was saying it was going to be the most fucked up release they ever did. And then he put that out. So
that kicks props, ass.
Props. No props to him at all. Don't ever have me on record as saying props to Seth.
You'll never get a job, man.
I'll never get a job.
It's contrary to what I may have said earlier, you don't gotta hand it to ISIS. Yeah, that kicks ass. Surely there are, you know, this is a strange thing, but Bad Religion, you know, that punk band that's been around for like 40 years, like in the 80s, they you know, when they were putting out hardcore punk records, I think it was their second record was called Into the Unknown, and it was like a strange like prog record, and everyone fucking hated it. It sold like zero copies. So the next record was called, I think it was Back to the Known.
For our power metal dudes, which there are none of them except me, but for our power metal dudes, Blind Guardian released A Twist in the Myth. People were very unhappy with that record.
Ah, yes. Not enough dragons.
No, there was a dragon on the cover, but it just not really a dragon in lyric. So strange, very strange album. Like they tried to do something a little more radio hitty. The drummer hated the direction so much that he quit. Toman Stotch, quit the band to go start like Tomorrowland or something. But yeah, that's another one. It's another one that the band has since totally recovered from, but just people didn't like it.
Blind Guardian, right?
Blind Guardian, right.
Sorry, I was confusing it with like one of the other Dragon bands. You know what?
They're the Dragon band, man. They the big hit from that album was Another Stranger Me. They had this awful music video for it where the lead singer with his like thinning long hair was like, you know, I don't know, they all dressed up like a noir detective story. It was terrible.
That rules. I feel like we would be remiss to like end this discussion about black marks on a band's legacy if we didn't talk about Turbo by Judas Priest. I mean, personally, I like this record a lot because it's fun and cheesy, and I don't really give a fuck. But Turbo Lover is a very, very gay song. I say that not derisively, just to say that it's a homosexual man singing about an extremely gay song.
Yeah, man, he gay.
But it kicks ass though. Like it's
yeah, no,
like it's, I love that like synthesizer classic. Like crawl into it. You know, it's very masculine in a way.
Well, we can't talk about Judas Priest stuff you don't like without talking about our good buddy Ripper.
Yeah.
Oh God.
Jugulator.
Tim, he's the guy who's in bands that nobody wants. He started out, you got Judas Priest, then he had Iced Earth. That was another one. Iced Earth's Glorious Retribution or something. They had that premiere album with Tim Ripper Owens after Matt Barlow left the band to go become a cop after 9/11.
Yeah.
Weird. I was telling about you guys about this on the show once.
No, I completely forgot. That's such weird. Okay.
Right. No one gave a shit about that because Tim Ripper Owens, he just doesn't match anybody.
It's funny, Joe, your lead up into what you were going to announce. I thought you were going to announce something different, but it did remind me. Machine Head.
Oh, God. How have we made it almost an hour into this show without talking about Machine Head?
It's because a tease. We wanted people to listen for this long to hear about the good stuff.
Here's a little teaser for fans of this show. Subscribe to our Patreon. The next bonus show is going to feature us talking about the lineage and the many confusing career moves of Machine Head. Go over to
great. Now
go to patreon.com/toiletofhell. Some I don't know. Use Google. Fucking find us. You'll find it.
Yeah. Now I have to actually listen to Machine Head, so I might be absent. I don't know. Just kidding. Okay.
There is.
I just won't like it.
I think this has been a tremendous. Have we learned anything from this discussion other than like I want to talk about more of these records because it's been a lot of fun?
I think the lesson is don't change what works for you. Really.
Yeah. I think not to interrupt, but I just think that that's a good point, and a lot of people. You know, they complain as artists saying like, well, we got to grow. We can't make the same album over and over again. And it's like, you don't have to do that. Nobody's asking you to do that. But if you're a band that's known for a style in a certain genre, I mean, if you venture outside of that, people get mad.
Well, let's talk on our next show about bands that have not changed once in their entire career.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I could think of at least a couple.
Yeah, I got several in mind. Before I let everybody go today, I'd like to introduce a new feature. Is that okay with y'all?
Yeah.
Okay. So what I did was I set up a Google voicemail for this show. If you want to call a number, you can leave a voicemail for us. We will play it on the show. It's literally anything that you want to broadcast, as long as you're not, you know, gross. Don't be gross or weird. Let us know what you're listening to, what you like, what's on your mind. If you call 903-884-6533, you can leave a voice message for us. We'll play it on the show. Again, that phone number is 903-884-6533. And, yeah, you can join the vocal toilet mailbag. How about that?
Sick. One more thing for our listeners. If you guys have any albums that you think we should have featured or talked about on the show, absolutely go in our comments and tell us about it. Or at us, at Joe Thrash and Kill for Joe Thrash and Kill, at 365 Days of Horror for that guy, and at That's Not Metal for me, and just let us know which albums ruined careers or should have ruined careers for bands that were otherwise really good.
Yeah, and if you guys like this enough, who knows, maybe we'll do a part two for you.
Hell yeah.
Well, this has been the Toilet of Hell Radio Show. I have been Joe Thrash and Kill.
Is that for me?
Yeah.
I've been Brent Aside.
I'm 365 Days of Horror.
Y'all be good. We'll see you next week.
Bye. We'll be right back.
You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.